You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here on The Comedian's Comedian, the podcast that gets inside the minds of your favourite comedy performers and finds out how they create, how they process, how they develop and how they cope. Today, I'm very pleased to be speaking to Paul Zerdin, who has a career much broader than many people that have been on this show, despite him specialising in one thing to a really fine art. He is a ventriloquist. He won America's Got Talent in 2017, despite being British. I've no idea how that works. But he is absolutely incredible and is capable of just reducing people to fits. He's got one of those old school approaches, which, not surprising, he's been in the business for a long time and has done everything from panto to light entertainment, holiday camps, cruise ships, and as well has a foot firmly placed in the alternative slash mainstream comedy circuit. We're going to hear more about that from Paul himself, and a shout out, there is loads of extra stuff from this interview in the Insiders Club, so go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to hear all of the extras from this and every episode that has them, which is tons now. Also, some exclusive Insiders only recordings of Zoom events featuring Fern Brady, Alfie Brown, Nish Kumar, James Acaster, and the How Comedians Cope self-help special with psychologist Amanda Donnett. All of that and more Insiders only Zoom Q&A events to come, so there is no reason not to join it at all. Here is Paul Zerdin. How are you doing, Paul Zerdin? Thanks for coming on the show. How have you been coping with the last year? Are things getting back to normal? What have you been doing with your time as a live act? What? How have you found it?
It's been an interesting time, hasn't it? Really, I've actually been really lucky. Last year, I was particularly lucky. So when the lockdown started in March, and I love going to the gym, I love running, I love working out. When they shut the gym, I started running more, and I was running miles every day, and I got my creative juices really flowing. I was due to start work in the summer for Butlins, and I'd been having a dialogue with them over those few months from March up until the summer, and it was like, you know, entertainment was doomed forever, and then there was a bit of light, then it, you know, it's been up and down for everyone. And I had a dialogue with them, and then they decided they'd take the shows outside, and so they put up these outdoor stages, which were like kind of, you know, big concert stages, and they just said, you're gonna have to do more shows. So I used to do 3 shows on a Friday, 3 on a Saturday, 3 on a Sunday. So from July right the way through to the end of September, I was working. I was doing 9 shows a week, and so okay. I felt really fortunate because I knew that most people weren't working. And I love doing outdoor gigs. I've done gigs, you know, for the troops in Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, festivals, that sort of thing. So it was, you know, it was like doing a normal gig, except when it rained, the audience got wet, but then that's, you know, that's what happens when you do outdoor gigs. But most of the time, and there was very much a sense of, you know, the British, you know, we'll get through this together. And you'd look out, it didn't rain very much actually, but when it did, not many people left. They sat there in the rain with their beer, watching a gig, you know. So it was actually a really, you know, it was a really fun experience, and I felt very fortunate. I finished doing those outdoor gigs in end of September, and then I did a week of shows in Yeovil as part of the Octagon Theatre and Westland entertainment thing. It was sort of piloting a socially distanced show inside. And then okay. I did a week's run in Blackpool at the Horseshoe by the Pleasure Beach. And then I went and did the Pantoland at the Palladium. And so all year, through the year, we'd been talking, me and the people organising all these different things, about, you know, what if it doesn't work, worst case scenario. And so I've been lucky enough to be at the Palladium the last 5 years now in the Panto. And there's a little group of us. It's me, Julian Clary, Nigel Havers, Gary Wilmot, and is that it? And then, yeah, I think that's it. And then we'll have like Diversity 1 year, or Elaine Page or Paul O'Grady. Okay. But we've been like the regulars. And the producer said, he's not going to spend money on a brand new production with costumes and sets in case the show gets pulled. So he came up with Pantoland at the London Palladium. And it was a variety show, basically, which the Palladium pantomime is anyway. There's usually a little bit of a very thin plot and lots of lovely costumes and amazing effects and stuff. And it's a big, lavish production. But this time it was fairly simple. It still looked amazing, but it was, you know, me doing my sort of greatest hits, as it were, Julian doing some of the best bits from the shows that we've done already. And it worked really well. And the government had told our boss that no matter what happened at Christmas, that the Westminster Council would keep the Palladium open. So we rehearsed for 2-3 weeks, and then we opened, and then we shut after 6 shows because they closed us down. So it was quite an interesting time, and I've done panto virtually every year since I was about 20, and so it was really odd having Christmas off. So we shut down just before Christmas, and then normally on Christmas Day, you know, I'll have a few drinks and know that I've got to stop drinking by a certain time because I've got a matinee on Boxing Day. So I could drink myself senseless on Christmas Day, knowing that I didn't have a matinee to do in panto. So that was weird. I mean, it was kind of nice in a way to have Christmas off, but it felt really odd.
This has brought up some fascinating stuff. Congratulations on working progressively through the pandemic, which is just so unusual. But one of the things that it really sparks off for me is, like, in what circuit do you exist? In what circuit do you feel you most belong? Because if I think of the things I know about you, I associate you before the America's Got Talent stuff, we'll get onto all of that. Before all of that kind of injection of whatever that was, I suppose I thought of you as a sort of a circuit act, which to me is the kind of the mainstream comedy circuit, because I think I opened for you at the Redgrave Theatre in Bristol many, many years ago, maybe like 12 years ago, something like that. So as I was coming up as a comic, I was aware of you, gigged with you, and then was like, oh, right, he's one of us. Which isn't to say that it should be, demarcated into us and them or anything else.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I heard about you in the context of America's Got Talent, and you've got, just because of that, or at least partly because of that, you've got this enormous body of work online, which is the glitziest, most sparkly looking stuff.
Right.
And yet, I was Googling as I was kind of going through your stuff on YouTube, I found a clip of you doing the Yeovil pantomime in 93.
Oh my God, there you go.
Being buttons, doing crowd work with some kids.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so is that the place you feel, I don't mean specifically Yeovil, but is that the circuit, that kind of, I don't know, I want to say end of the pier. Is that pejorative? But well, do you know what I mean? Those kind of like holiday camps, Butlins, those kind of things. Is that the core of your background? Well, where do you feel you fit most?
I guess, I started as a magician, and I used to do close-up magic and cabaret, and then I started doing holiday camps and cruise ships when I was about 17. And so, and then I auditioned for a job as a TV presenter, and I got the gig, and I used to present a kids show, on GMTV for a couple of years called Rise and Shine. And then on the back of that, I then got billed in pantomime, and then liked pantomime and kind of learned how to do it. And then kind of panto became an annual thing. It was like, where are you doing panto this year? It was just one of those things. So I got into that world, and then I did holiday camps. And when the contract ended as a presenter, I carried on doing holiday camps and then cruise ships. And then I entered a talent competition, my first one, which was the Big Talent Show with Jonathan Ross on ITV. And I won that. And then from that, that got me into doing, you know, a summer season in Blackpool, appearing on Royal variety shows and the more kind of light entertainment TV side of things. And at that time, I think I'd done a year or 2 years in Blackpool with my own show, and my then agent said, and they offered me another contract in Blackpool, and I turned it down because she says you need to be seen, you need more television, and the only place you're going to get seen is on the comedy circuit. So I went and did an open spot for the Comedy Store and Jonglers, and then got into the comedy circuit. So
immediately, one would imagine, because by then you have just a bulletproof act.
Well, I've been doing it for quite a long time by then, but you know, whereas some people just start on the comedy circuit, whether it be a room above a pub or whatever, I had I'd started in some quite big rooms, and some massive rooms at like Haven and Butlins and Pontins and all those kind of places where there's kids running around screaming and you know, all sorts going on. And so you kind of learn to cope quite quickly. So going into the comedy circuit and, you know, the late show at the Comedy Store, which I'd been to see and thought, oh, I can get a bit leery. I don't know. For some reason, I wasn't particularly fazed by it. I still had to change bits and pieces. And I thought, actually, in a way, when you're doing the comedy circuit, I wrote with a couple of people and we started to write slightly different material. So material that I could do at the Comedy Store wouldn't necessarily work at say a massive, great big, you know, holiday park with kids running around. So in a way I could be slightly cleverer with the humor. That does sound a bit wanky now, but I could try different things. So I did a whole routine about being schizophrenic, and the puppet points out that I am actually mad because I'm talking to myself. And it was quite a clever routine. It was a routine that I loved doing, but it didn't work in a big brash holiday park scenario. But I could do it at the comedy circuit, or I could do it at Jonglers for some reason. I don't know why, an Edinburgh show. Okay. So I liked the fact that I could kind of juggle two sort of circuits in a way. I think maybe having the experience from starting out in those big rooms in the holiday parks gave me the experience that I needed to be able to just walk in and do the Comedy Store. But I remember Don Ward said to my agent, and she was desperately trying to get me an open spot there, and it took ages, and he said, no, I don't want a ventriloquist in the Comedy Store. It's not right. And she said, please just let him have a go. I promise you that, you know, you won't have seen anything like this, or whatever she said. And I went and I did 6 minutes, and I was talking to Boothby the other day because he was comparing, and I did his Zoom show, and we were chatting about it, and he said, you know, Don was like sitting at the back going, yeah, go on then. And I had a really nice time. And I have to say, I loved it. And the Comedy Store now is one of my absolutely favorite gigs anywhere in the world. Yeah. I'm not saying it was a breeze, but I just thought, oh my God, okay, this is no wonder people go crazy about the Comedy Store. It's like the best gig because it's just so perfectly laid out. And I think, you know, you'd have to be really shit to fuck it up. But I've had some great nights there, but I've had some harder nights there as well, especially, you know, when you're closing the late show at 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, we have to have a duffer of a gig every so often. It's just the nature of things. But I love doing those clubs.
That spirit of like Don Ward stood at the back of his club, arms folded, thinking, go on then. That kind of prejudice. Yeah. Have you encountered that much on the comedy circuit? Because the kind of the light entertainment or the variety circuit, I sort of imagine, I suppose my assumption is that there were some people who were like, some people in the dressing room who maybe felt the same as Don.
Yeah.
Did you come across that at all?
I think so, actually. And I had that from time to time at various gigs. I'm trying to think of particular instances, but I'm not going to name names. I actually can't remember who this was, but someone said to me in the dressing room, and it was at Jonglers somewhere, maybe Battersea. And they said, why are you doing this? I'm like, what do you mean? Why am I doing this? Why are you here? You know, you work all these other places. Well, why can't I work here? And I genuinely can't remember who this was, but I remember having this conversation thinking, oh, okay. He said, oh yeah, but we've, you know, you do TV, you do pantomime, you do, you know, your summer seasons, you do other stuff. Why are you doing this? It was like, why are you coming onto our circuit? And I remember thinking, oh, okay. And that was the first time I thought, oh, right. There is a bit of sort of snobbery about this then and some sort of divide, which I basically, you know, I started showing off when I was like a kid with a magic set and puppets and Sesame Street characters. And I just used to do puppet shows and magic shows and annoy the hell out of my family. And I knew I was going to be a bit weird and not carry on my education after I finished school. And I just wanted to just, you know, it sounds a bit kind of over the top. I just wanted to entertain, but I just wanted to show off and do something. And I never wanted to be a straightforward stand up. I always wanted to do comedy, but I wanted to have a reason to be there. And the puppets and the magic and that kind of stuff seemed to just fit really well for some reason. And I wasn't conscious of, you know, the fact that, oh, there's a comedy circuit. That's the alternative circuit. And then there's this so-called mainstream, or was this so-called mainstream, because the alternative circuit has become the mainstream and,
it's all
changed. But I wasn't conscious of that. I was, you know, I left school. I got myself an agent. I started working in all, she said to my agent, said to me, just be able to work everywhere and you'll always work. And I thought that's a really good, you know, that's a good sort of ethos. It's a good way to look at things, really, because, you know, you can do gigs when you do. I do private functions. I do corporate gigs. And when you do a private function, sometimes, you know, they'll pay you fantastic money and you might be in someone's back garden doing very wealthy people's, you know, 50th wedding anniversary or a 60th birthday party. And I get paid to do all sorts of gigs, and there'll be kids on the floor. There'll be you'll be grandparents and, you know, sitting around. I'll be heckled by a dog. You know, you just learn to cope in any situation. A gig's a gig as far as I'm concerned. So I was never conscious or never really thought about, you know, these different circuits. I just thought if you're an entertainer, you should be able to work every audience. Of course you can't. There will always be gigs that you can't, you know, you'll turn up at a corporate at 12 o'clock and they're all absolutely wankered and the room's bad and the pillar and the sound and everything's against you. You're going to die. You're just going to die. It's the, you know, you can't win them all. But I always thought, you know, you should be able to try and entertain any crowd.
When you go into a room which you think, oh, this is unplayable. Yeah. You know, a corporate where everyone's been hammered for hours.
Yeah.
Or I think of like one of the worst ones of my life was a Jongleurs gig in Leeds, where they'd run out of Christmas dinners and placated the crowd with free wine for several hours before the show. So it was like absolutely unplayable. What do you sort of say to yourself before you go into those things? I mean, you are as close to a bomb-proof act as I can think of, because you are so experienced. You've got special skills. Do you know what I mean? You know, people casually refer to the guitar as a cheating stick in stand-up circles because, like, you can always get a round of applause. But you've got genuine skill as well as actual bulletproof jokes. So when you go into those things, when you like, are there times when you think even the everything that I've got can't do this? What do you kind of tell yourself internally to cope with it?
I remember turning up at the Great Room in Grosvenor House, which Bob Monkhouse nicknamed the Comedian's Graveyard. And if you've ever done
I've played that room and I didn't know that, and that's made me feel a lot better.
You know, it's known for being a pretty tough room to work, because you've got most of the audience on either side of the stage. If they have the stage in the middle where they normally do, there's a massive dance floor in front of you, and the bulk of the audience are on your left, on your right, and you've got like one row, the sort of the head tables right in front of you across this big dance floor. And they have to have screens. And I think the only way I've ever made it work is when they have screens either side of the stage and you play it like a TV gig. So you play it to the camera, and the audience on the left and right are watching screens. They know you're there, but they're watching the screens. And so, it's almost like playing a really hard TV gig. But the last time I was there, actually, I remember looking down from the balcony, and there was, it was an awards night. And before I got there, when I was there for the sound check, and there was Alan Dedicote was doing the voice of God.
Oh yeah.
And he kind of, I bump into him at these sort of things all the time. And, you know, he's lovely man. And he looked at me and went, well, you've got your work cut out this evening. And I went, why? He went, well, that table there, they've been playing drinking games since 4:30, you know. And so this is like 6 o'clock, and I'm just doing a quick 1-2 on the mic, and I'm not on until 10:30. So you know that you're it's not going to end well. And the only way to get through it is to think of the money. and you know, I can, if I have a tough gig, I can die. I'm happy to, I mean, no one wants to die, but you know, you've got to try and do your time, do as best you can. Just think, actually, you're not going down a mine. Your life isn't in danger. Oh, it might be if there's an ashtray, you know, thrown at you. But generally, you know, you can't win them all, and things are stacked against you. I remember doing a gig And I'm not particularly, my sport is tennis. I love tennis. I'm not really into football. I used to play rugby and cricket at school. Not into football at all. And I got booked for these awards in Liverpool. And my agent said, oh, it's media awards. I said, yeah, it says that on the contract, but what is it? She went, I don't know. I said, can we find out what this is? Yeah, yeah, sure. And then I never got to find out. So I turned up and a mate of mine came with me. And I think it was at the Moat House in Liverpool. And I got there about 4 o'clock and we were wandering around and my friend Nick, who's really up on football, went, oh my God, that's Michael Owen. That's another footballer. Yeah. And I'm thinking, oh, this isn't good. This is going to be some big Larry football type gig. And we look in the room, and there's all sorts of, you know, awards going on, and it's the Liverpool Sports Personality of the Year awards. And I looked at it and I just thought, oh no, this is a mistake. They should not have booked me. They need to book, you know, Jimmy Tarbuck or, you know, some really good Scouse comic that knows about sport and football. And I just thought, oh no, I just knew it was going to be not good. And I was supposed to be on between 10 and half past, and I went on at about 4 minutes to midnight. And I followed Gerard Houllier, who was the guest of honour. He'd just recovered from a triple heart bypass operation, and it was his first public appearance since the operation. And the audience went absolutely nuts. And then the comic who I didn't know who was introduced me, and I lasted 4 minutes. And oh, it was like, it was too late. I was the wrong act for that occasion, and everything was against me. And I just thought, well, what can you do? They had to pay me because I was supposed to be going on between 10 and half past. So I went on at 4 minutes to midnight. You know, what chance did I have? I did 4 minutes, and then I wasn't booed off or anything. It was like, I was just ignored.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was just,
do you have a get out line for that? Do you have gear for getting off stage?
It's been a challenge and you've won. Thank you. Good night.
and in terms of like your opener, when you're in the wings at 4 minutes or whatever it is, 10 minutes to midnight, selecting what stuff to open with, like presumably you have some flexibility as to like, okay, if they're Larry, I'll go in with this bit first. And then you, as I guess at a gig like that, you've got a suitcase with you with Albert, with Sam, with baby.
I've got a little holdall.
Brought certain options.
It's all pretty relaxed. And I always start with a little bit of stand up. I might just take the mic out and start doing the out of sync thing where the microphone is out of sync with my own voice with the sound check, because it kind of looks clever. And it's different, and you know, it's kind of original, and it's stand up, but with ventriloquism, and it's not just, you know, when they say a ventriloquist, you instantly think puppet. So I've come at it from a different angle to start with, and sometimes that usually helps, that usually breaks the ice. But sometimes you just think, I'll get the puppet out and just have a go at them, you know, and just literally just lay straight into them with abuse, and that usually works. But then sometimes at that time of night. And in that sort of scenario, they're just looking at you. And I've done a lot of sporting dos, actually, a lot of cricket dos, and they're usually all right, but you will have a bad one occasionally. And this was a bad one. If you do get the puppet out, you're suddenly not this, you know, act that they might see on telly. You're just a grown man with a puppet on your arm, and you just look like a twat. And so
that's really interesting. Go on, sorry.
I'm just conscious of that. That's how I felt sometimes, where I just thought, you know, normally I can go on and I've got, you know, an air of confidence, not arrogance, but confidence, because I know what I'm doing. And like you said, I've got a reasonably, you know, I've got quite a high track record, but a high hit rate, but you just can't win them all. And sometimes you just think, no, Zerdin. And it's like, actually, it's quite a good little kind of, you know, brings you back down to earth. It's like, Zerdin, no, look at you. You're just a grown man with a fucking doll on your arm and you look like an absolute bell end. That's all you are. And it, you know, it's, it does make me laugh. I just say, oh God, you know, you feel a complete idiot, but only for a minute. I'm not one of these acts that gets in the car and is like literally just obsessing about it. Why didn't it work? Yeah. Why didn't it work? It will, if I'm doing a run of shows, like I'll tell you about the Vegas thing. That was a thing where I obsessed about getting it right. But a corporate is a gig and it'll be forgotten. It'll be forgotten I was already forgotten while I was on. So, you know, so there's no point letting it ruin your life or ruin your night, you know, because there'll be another gig.
Got it. So this is Paul. It's such a tonic to talk to someone who is so irrepressibly optimistic, really robust in his thinking, and just has grown up working hard. I wouldn't even say he's trained himself to work hard. That's just his approach. And I'm always in awe of people like that who, as we talk about in the interview, I've always felt that that is something that a background in magic tends to bring to a performer's life, whereby they go, if I learn this, if I put the hours in and practice, then this is achievable. There seems to be a lot less stumbling and tripping over genius moments in magic than there can be in comedy sometimes. And maybe it instills a sort of de facto hard work ethic in magicians. But hey, we know lots of comics work hard as well. More from this interview in just a second. I am starting to work live again, but I don't know if I have. I'm not going to pretend I'm not talking to people about doing something in Edinburgh. So keep your eyes peeled and your ears. What would you do with an ear? Buffed. Keep your ears buffed, because I will hopefully be able to tell you on a forthcoming episode before too long exactly what is happening, how and when and where. But keep an eye on my Twitter at ComComPod to find out if I'm going to be somewhere near you soon. I've got some gigs coming up for the Roffle Comedy Clubs in Derby and Newcastle under Lyme, and I'm doing something special in London at Picture House before too long as well. So keep them peeled and buffed, and you can find out lots more about Paul. He very kindly gave me lots of his time in the Insiders Club. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders, and you'll have noticed I'm talking at slightly increased volume now because Future Girl is pranging out in the background. So I hope that doesn't disturb your listening experience too much. Let's get back to this interview with a man who you can find at on Twitter at Paul Zerdin, on paulzerdin.com, and indeed at youtube.com/paulzerdin, because he's one of very few comedy performers who's bothered to sort out their YouTube name such that it is discoverable and not random. A little feather in Paul's cap there. Let's get back to Paul Zerdin.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
From the perspective of being someone who can play anywhere, like so my background before I became a comic, I was a street performer at Covent Garden, and I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Yeah. Of like, I've put myself in some hellish situations. Sure. You know, I've been bottled on. I did a gig once in Sheffield where I walked on stage and someone threw a Jack Daniels bottle at my feet, which exploded. Do you know what I mean? Like, right. You know, it shattered. Yeah. It didn't explode. That would have been even worse. But do you know what I mean? Like, there have been some hairy kind of things. And I suppose for a lot of the early part of my stand-up career, I felt like, this has made me tougher. I can cope with anything. It's made me adaptable. These are all positive qualities.
Yeah.
And then I suppose as my stand-up became a bit more mature and a bit more finessed, I wondered to myself, did those things help me develop nuance, or did they kind of turn me into a bat that could kind of smack down any problem? I don't mean necessarily hecklers, but do you know what I mean? Like, did those things improve me as a comic, or did they blunt me as a comic because of the trauma involved? And I wonder if that's something you've ever kind of considered. Like, the value of being able to play anywhere is that you can play anywhere.
Yeah.
But does that mean that you sacrifice a certain degree of nuance because the stuff becomes broader?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer. I think if you are, like, for example, the first time I did Leighton Live in Edinburgh, when it was at the old Gilded Balloon, and I was doing the studio, I think it was the studio. It was called the studio in the old Gilded Balloon. And I'd never heard of Leighton Live. And so Karen Corran said, we need to give you some more promotion for your show, because I was a last minute addition. I think Jerry Sadovitz had pulled out, so I got the room, but very last minute. Mm-hmm. And they said, we need to get you on Late in Live as much as possible. So Adam Hills and Ross Noble were comparing. And I remember being in the dressing room, at, like, I must have been about 2 o'clock in the morning, one or two, and Marcus Brigstocke walking in going, I smell death, you know. And I remember thinking, oh, okay. And everyone was talking about, oh, fucking hell, Late in Live, oh, good luck with that. I'm like, I didn't know anything about it. So in a way, I went into it so ignorant, so naive, that actually... It helped me, and I got a standing ovation one night at Late in Live, and my then agent was going absolutely nuts, and apparently that was quite a big deal. But yeah, you had to go at it quite sort of, you know, go in quite hard, and yeah, there'd be a certain pace where I wouldn't be able to then suddenly do something a bit maybe a bit more thoughtful or subtle. So yeah, you have to play, you have to gauge it, don't you, really? So you, yeah, you have to try and work out what the room wants. I do like taking a risk. I do a thing where I hear people's thoughts, and I go into the audience and I put my hand over people's heads and I do their voice of what they're thinking about the show, and they're commenting on the show. And I have a bit that was in my last tour, which has kind of grown, where I talk about voiceovers, and I love voices and voiceovers, and I'm always conscious of whose voice is being used as a voiceover on a TV show. And there's a thing I do with talking about the patronizing voiceover that's on one of these cookery shows, you know, explaining exactly what we can see. David is chopping onions. And I do it as a ventriloquist. So I start narrating my own life in out and about situations. I talk about the fun you can have when you're just doing a voiceover, narrating your whole life. And I like doing it during the show when I'm in my show talking about, you know, Zerdin is in a coffee shop. He's at the very end of a long queue. At the other end of the queue is a man who can't decide whether to order a skinny cappuccino or a mocha choco coca latte. He wishes the man would pay his £10 and fuck off. And then I do a gag about it, gets a laugh. And this is all without me moving my lips.
Sure.
And then I will leave it a beat, and I go, Zerdin was expecting a slightly bigger laugh on that last gag. And that gets a big laugh, and Zerdin realises pointing out the gag didn't get a laugh, actually got a bigger laugh. And then I start doing a commentary on the audience's laughter on that gag. And right, it builds, and then it drops, and it's Zerdin's notice the audience, the reaction is dwindling. Oh, but then there's a woman with a funny laugh. That's making that little pocket of the audience laugh even more, and it starts up again. And you can comment on the whole audience. And it'll come back in the show. So someone gets up to go to the toilet, Zerdin's wondering where they're going. Are they going to the toilet, or, you know, whatever? And I love that. And it's, you can't do that in a if you're going out in an outdoor gig and you've got, you know, kids running around, that there's certain material that it just won't work. It's too subtle. But in a theatre, when people have come to see you, then you can really play with things. So that's what I love about being on tour, and you know, they'd come to see you as well, so it makes it slightly easier.
And do you find it's interesting, I don't think I knew you were a magician before you were a ventriloquist, but it kind of makes sense from what I know of magicians. I think that I have a preconception of magicians as like, I guess you're in your late 40s, you've got great skin, you work out. Magicians seem to know how to do life, do you know what I mean? Because I think there is some aspect where if you get into magic as a kid and you go, oh, you can learn stuff via books and DVDs and improve yourself in the way, maybe in like a sort of more, just a more way than being a juggler. Like I learned to juggle when I was 16. I went, oh, there's a thing I can't do. And I just learned how to do it. And now I feel really empowered.
Yeah.
And there is something about magic whereby it is kind of chopped up into sections and made modular. And like, here is the bit, here is the patter that comes with the bit. Here's the material. Here's the jokes. Yeah. Here's the props.
Yeah.
And provided you engage with them and learn them, it becomes quite an NLP way of living your life. Quite a sort of, does any of that make sense? Like you kind of go, it's almost like magic comes with lots of things with sets of instructions.
Yeah.
And if you get good at following the instructions and self-discipline and practice and training, then you reap rewards.
Yes.
And so it seems to me that far more so than in comedy, where it's all a bit like, if you stare out of the window at the right time whilst just drunk enough, you have a brilliant idea for a thing, and you can be a sort of slovenly hobo of a starving artist. You know, there is that sort of model of a comedian.
Yeah.
It seems to me magic is far more like, follow these steps and you will achieve X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
And that gets embraced as a lifestyle.
Yeah, well, magic, you know, I started doing from about the age of 10, and then I did it professionally for a few years. And then I got sick of, when I was doing close-up magic, I got sick of people telling me to get lost when I was approaching the table, whether they're trying to have a romantic dinner for two and I'm saying, hey, pick a card, you know, or yeah. or going up to a table at a corporate event or whatever. And people were, I just couldn't believe how rude people were. You know, could you make this, could you refill this bottle of wine? Yes, I could, but you wouldn't want to drink it. You know, you learn how to cope yeah. in these situations, but I got sick of people being so negative towards it. And if I was at a table and a magician came up, I would be like, oh, this is brilliant. Yeah, show us some magic. But not everyone's like that. They're, you know, people in different situations can be horrible. But I always had the magic as my background. So ventriloquism is related to magic because it's all deception. It's all illusion. So I'm creating the illusion that this character is real, whether he's, well, one of the things I love doing is, you know, having the bag or the box or whatever they're in, and just I'm having a conversation with myself, pretending that there's these little characters in there, and people buy it, whether it's at the comedy store, you know, or at a, you know, a corporate event. But people, they somehow go with it, and it's all illusion. So in the new show, I've got Albert, my old man character. He does a mind reading magic trick. Where he's blindfolded, and then he sends me into the audience to get someone to pick a card, and then he can't remember okay. what he was talking about because he's sort of senile. But I'm controlling him with a mini controller in my hand and voicing him with a microphone, but he's on stage and he's animatronic. And so it's using this kind of magic technology and yeah. puppetry all in one. And that's my magic background. That's, you know, I want to be a magician on stage now doing David Copperfield type stuff, but I'm never going to do that. So this is my way of doing it. You know, it's kind of, it's okay. sort of snuck in.
Is that right? So your take on yourself is that as a ventriloquist, not that you're a failed magician, but that you would be a magician if you could.
Yeah. But at the time of starting out as a magician, my agent looked after lots of magicians. She said, I've got loads of magicians. What have you got that's different? And I said, well, I'm learning ventriloquism. And she said, well, go away and practice that and come back when you've got an act. So that made me go down that path, really. So
okay.
it was all her
presumably, fault. Presumably now, though, you have sufficient kind of time and opportunity
yeah.
to, like, have you ever considered kind of putting the vent stuff on pause and getting back into magic? Because as a charismatic magician, I mean, there are not, you know what I mean? I always think there's a gap in the market for magicians with actual charisma.
Right,
I mean?
That's interesting. I like to do it as a hobby, really. And it kind of sneaks into the show, into okay. my comedy show. Sort of via the back door, through the trap door. It's an extra layer that I can play with. So I've got the ventriloquism, I've got the puppets on their own, and they're doing magic as well. I think that's enough. Yeah. I would never really want to be. I'd love to be in a Copperfield type. When I started doing magic, it was a cross between Copperfield and Tommy Cooper. It was a mishmash of illusions and kind of like taking the piss out of it. So it was always going to be yeah. comedy related. But I like the way that I can do it with a puppet and I'm actually doing a trick. So the trick does actually work in the end, but the puppet's done it, but he doesn't realize how he's done it. The audience think, hang on a minute, was that supposed to happen? Yes. Oh my God, he got the card in the end. So it all happens by accident, but
yes, gotcha.
I love that whole, you know, and no one's doing that. So I think that's, you know, I'll keep doing that. And I've been working on a way of, I do the mask thing, the ventriloquist mask, and I have an animatronic version of it. So I came up with, you know, the mask thing has been in various forms over the years, has been going for a long time, making people from the audience talk. Wayne Dobson mm-hmm. did it, you know, without masks. He used to make them talk when he was mm-hmm. doing his magic. Various ventriloquists have done it a long, long time ago. And I came up with the idea of doing an animatronic thing. So a man and a woman are on stage and I leave them on stage and I go in the wing or I'm in the audience voicing them and controlling them, getting them to do silly okay. things. And I've got them in my Vegas show. I used to get them to do magic.
God.
I love, you know, just seeing what you can get people to do. So I'm living my magical fantasy through puppets and humans.
Yes,
on stage.
Gotcha. Okay. And when it comes to the developing of bits, it's really interesting. I can see your sort of obvious glee at creating a thing or kind of putting two things that already exist together mm-hmm. in a different way. Mm-hmm. And that's, there are obviously links there with just, you know, with non-prop related stand-up, whereby yeah. you go, okay, there's a premise, that chunk, I'm going to play that premise
yeah.
for a while,
yeah.
then I'm going to play that premise. whereby I can never, every so often someone says to me, what's a good example of a premise? And I just haven't got one off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like the spirit might be, I hate shopping,
yeah.
But the premise is like, I'd rather be at war than shopping. And then you kind of put the two ideas together,
yeah.
For example.
Yeah.
So makes note. Yeah, that could work.
That's good.
So, so because of that kind of modular element of magic, and I guess ventriloquism as well, when you say, okay, now this is going to be a baby bit. This is going to be the bit where baby's in the case and no one sees him, or baby's in the carrier and no one sees him, or this is the bit where Sam's alone on stage and he suddenly starts talking, mm-hmm. or whichever those bits are, is it the ones you just described as well. I wonder if you could talk to me a bit about coming up with those bits, how that happens, whether it's you're working on something else and the notion just pops into your head, or whether you find yourself sat in front of a blank piece of paper thinking, right, got to come up with a new bit.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Where do they arise from when you come up with a chunk like that, that you go, oh, I can play this? Mm. Or, you know, the voice is going around the room or something.
I mean, some of it comes by accident. Some of it I'm always thinking of stuff. So if you're writing a new show, I'm always thinking of what can I do? And I find now that I've got quite a good structure to the show. So in a way, I try and replace the openings with Sam. So Sam will do 10, 15 minutes at the top of the show. And so I've got a structure. So the puppets will all come in probably around about the same place. I didn't do the human dummies on the last tour because I felt that I'd been doing them for so long that the human ventriloquist dolls with the masks, I thought that everyone's seen it on telly. Nina Conti's been doing it. You know, lots of ventriloquists do it. It's a great bit. I thought maybe people are sick of it. And actually, it turns out that people, when I didn't do it on the last tour, people were like, oh, you didn't do that bit that we've seen.
Yeah, right.
So you kind of think, okay, well, I don't want people to go, oh, he always does this. So I try and, you know, make it all different and new. So I'm conscious now on this tour that I'll put that routine back in, but I've got different jokes and a different. It's the same structure, but they'll finish on some stupid song or dance where they look silly.
Yeah.
But I'm also conscious of, you know, I think people might be sick of wearing masks by the time I get out on tour in the autumn because we've been wearing them for the last year and whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm conscious that people want to see certain things. But there's usually a structure to it. I love a set piece. So, like with some music and some lighting and a storytelling bit. So one of my favorite routines, is where the baby wants a story, bedtime story. And that was one of my most watched clips on the, America's Got Talent, show. And that's where I read him a story and he changes it because he hates the evil character. He wants me to change it to a duck. And of course it ruins
the
story.
Yes, I've seen the bit, yeah.
I remember doing that live for a few years and it just kept getting better and better and better. And then when I put that forward as a potential spot for America's Got Talent, when I got to the I think it was the judges' cuts, whichever bit that was, I said, I'd like to do this on there. And they've got to check your script and all that, you know, NBC approval and blah, blah, blah. The lawyers look at everything. And they said, oh, we love this. I said, but I've got this I could do as well. No, we want this with the duck, the storytelling. It's very much family. It's perfect. Prime time NBC family audience stuff. And I did it. And I knew it would look good on camera and work well. And it's just a really, it's a great idea. And it was my friend Martin Beaumont's idea, not mine. And he wrote most of that. And I tweak it and change it and rework it. And as you do when you're working all the time, you know. It's just such a really good idea. And so that's, he ruins every story. Every story has a duck in it. And so the story doesn't work. But I want to be able to find a new version of that. So we've just been writing the new show and I'm like, I want to be able to do that, but you can't do that because we know he's going to change it to a duck. And it's like, it's been done. It's like, that's the gag. We can't do that. So we have to find another way. So now he's ruining nursery rhymes. So we've gone down a different route, not with a duck, but just changing things because he doesn't understand it. It doesn't make sense. And so I like having a structure. And you think if one thing works, then I can find something else to kind of replace it with. Doesn't always work. The old man, Albert, he's my favorite character in a way because you can do more with him because he's deaf or he's got selective deafness. So he can hear when he wants to hear. He's got selective senility. So he's all there really, but he's playing at being old. And also, you know, he's got to an age where he doesn't care what he says because he's 90 and he's not got long to live. And there's endless amounts of, you know, humor that can come out of that, whether it's the hearing stuff. We've got a routine in the show this year about his memory tests, the three worst things about getting old. It's finding a little something and then you can literally just hang all the jokes on it. And it's all about age and getting old. But then also he wants to do his magic act, so he does a magic trick because he used to do that during the war to entertain the boys. You can do anything. On the last tour, Albert had a conversation with his dead friend Wally. His wartime buddy Wally came back and he did a double act with his dead friend next to him. And I remember writing that routine some years ago and thinking, I wonder how far you can go with this. You know, there's me and there's a puppet and the puppet is now singing a song with his dead friend next to him. It's like, well, if they're believing that this puppet's real, they might believe that there's no one there. I don't know. It's ridiculous, isn't it, really? And that worked really well. So from then on, I thought, oh, okay. So if they believe in the puppet character, if he's real enough, then you can kind of do more or less anything. So
It's amazing, isn't it? The sort of the elasticity of people's belief.
Yeah.
Like once you've got them over the hump of, obviously this thing isn't real, but I'm going to just, it's the simplicity of ventriloquism, whereby simply because you've learnt the shapes to make with your mouth, to make it speak without your mouth moving.
Yeah.
They get invested in something made of foam. And then once they've done that, you've got them because you can get them further invested in everything.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, it does take a long time to get a character right. Albert took a long time. Sam, I've been working with for the longest. And then I've got an urban fox and I've got a bodyguard and the urban fox, I thought, oh, well, he's going to be, when I was working in America, and I signed a 3-year contract and then the contract ended before the contract was finished. I was thinking of a new character and I was going to go down. I was thinking about a coyote and then the contract finished. And so I came back here and I was touring in the UK. So I thought, oh, OK. And I'd commissioned this new puppet, but it hadn't, you know, got that far. So I thought, well, okay, let's do a fox, urban fox, and I thought, oh, that's a really good idea. Then someone said, oh, Keith Lemon did an urban fox character on his sketch show, and I watched it. I thought, oh yeah, that is similar, but not quite the same. But the puppet was halfway there already, so I thought, well, I'm going to continue down this road. And then I took it out on tour, and some of it worked, some of it didn't. So I shelved it for a while and thought, right, I'm not happy with that. And I had the bodyguard character, and the bodyguard wasn't working at all, and then suddenly I shelved the fox, put all my efforts into this bodyguard. He was a secret agent, and then he turned into my bodyguard, and it made sense that they'd given me a bodyguard when I won America's Got Talent. And then, even though this is a few years ago, he's still here, and I can't get rid of him. And his face makes me laugh now, and I've got his character, and I know who he is. But it's taken a few years to get right. I find it takes a long time. It's quite painful in some ways.
And what is it that takes the time? Is it trying things and sort of trying them on in front of an audience and seeing whether they ring true?
Yeah. Every night on tour, and I was working with Phil Butler, who does some writing for me, and he's my support act as well on the tour. And so he'll sit out there most nights, and he'll watch, and we'll rewrite the bits that didn't work that night. And then the next night we'll try. I'll be learning it before the next show. I mean, it's quite full on. And then we'll keep on tweaking it. But the bodyguard character just seemed to click in one night. And I just thought, oh, I've got it. Cause his voice was very much like that. Yes, sir. That's right. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, is it the voice? Maybe the voice didn't work. So one night he did the whole spot with like that. He was talking like that. And then suddenly became really kind of camp. And I thought the contrast, he looks butch, but they've got a very camp voice. Is that funny? And it wasn't funny, it turned out. And I went back to the deep voice. So it gives me a sore throat, but the voice was right. And then it worked out that he's kind of a Buzz Lightyear character. And then it does give you a bit of a headache, I must say. And, probably quite boring to hear about it, but it does take
a long time. Not at all.
It takes a long time, but I feel like the characters all know who they are now. And I know who they are.
Isn't that interesting that you, when you've got it right, is the urban fox, has he come back?
Yeah.
Have you nailed that one?
The fox is back now. Yeah. And I think I know who he is now.
Okay.
And it's much, once you know, then it's easier to write. It's easy to write for a baby because you know that he's obsessed with boobies and nappies and wants to know what everything is. And he's a baby, he's a child. Obviously, he's talking before his time. But, you know, Sam is a cheeky little shit. He's kind of like a Muppety Bart Simpson. And the old man is old and he's like an older version of Sam, basically, cheeky and doesn't care what he says because he's going to die soon. And a fox, you know, I always had an issue with, like, for example, watching ventriloquist when I was a kid. I don't really remember. I got to know Keith Harris later in life. I don't remember him on television. I think it was on, I don't know, I never saw his show. I remember Ray Allen, Lord Charles. I never saw Keith Harris, but someone having an animal puppet, like a duck or a monkey, I couldn't get my head around that. A human type character, a kid, baby, an old man, that made sense because they were human, even though they looked Muppety. Yeah. But when it came to an animal character, I just couldn't get my head around it. So when I got the fox, even though the fox puppet looked amazing, I still couldn't get my head around the fact that why the fuck would the fox be talking, you know? Now I can get my head around it and just think, well, everything else talks in your life. Why not? You know, why not a fox? So I know who he is now, and he knows who he is, I think.
That's such a strange, I mean, that very specific example of, like, why on earth would Keith Harris be talking to a duck?
Yeah, I know. There's no logic to any of this, but it's just, you've got to be able to get it clear in your head and then you know where you are. It's like, I've got a routine for a talking microphone, that I've been working on, and I'm not sure about it yet. I'll put it in. I'm doing some shows over the summer in Blackpool at the Horseshoe, every Friday and Saturday. And I'm putting new bits in. So there's lots of the new show in it already and some old bits. It's like greatest hits plus lots of new stuff. And so I can do, it's such a lovely room to work. I can put new bits in. And so I want to try the talking microphone. But I think it's just the microphone. Why would anyone believe that that's talking? Even though my lips aren't moving and there's a sound coming from somewhere. But then you think, well, hang on a minute. Why would they think that there's a kid in the bag talking? It doesn't.
It's my
head that's the problem, you know?
That's interesting. It's my head that's the problem. So no, I just want to stay with that for a second. The idea that it's your head that's the problem. It's your, like, one of the jobs for you is to overcome the hurdle of your own kind of, like, it's to stop getting in your own way regarding your imagination. Because I think what you've proved time and time again is they are invested in it. They do believe it. They do go with it. So you need to get the blocks out of the way to say, yes, I'm fine with this. And then it falls into place.
Yeah, it seems to. And even though this is turning into an episode of the psychiatrist's chair.
It always does, mate. I'm sorry. I should have said that up front.
No. It's good, though. But it's interesting because I remember doing a pilot for a sitcom. I had a sitcom idea, which I was have been trying to get off the ground for a long time. And I remember sitting down with the producer, with the production company, and we were going to shoot a pilot taster. So like a 10-minute episode with a couple of scenes from a half an hour, what would be a half an hour episode. And we sat in their offices and he said, with a big whiteboard, and he said, right, what are the rules? What are the rules of your show? It's you, you're the babysitter, you've got an old man you're looking after, you've got a kid and a baby. Okay, you've got a love interest, there's a woman next door that you fancy, and she comes in to do a bit of babysitting, and we're going to try and get you together. What's your relationship with the characters? Well, he's my, you know, I'm the babysitter. I'm the godparent, maybe, whatever the rules were, you know, whatever our characters were. He then said, what are the rules? Can the puppets be on their own? I said, yeah, I think they should be on their own. I think we should have them wandering around like Muppets. But I need to be able to voice them. Mm-hmm. So he said, okay, are you going to be puppeteering them? I said, yes. When there's a two shot and Sam is there saying, what are you doing? Well, I'm trying to do some work on this, you know, this project, whatever. That should be a two shot. So it should be me and the puppet talking. Yeah. But then when it cuts to a wide shot and Sam goes off upstairs, we have a puppeteer take over. But I can still say, Sam, what are you doing up there?
Yeah.
You going upstairs?
Yeah.
Make sure you come down.
Okay.
You know, and so he would be lip syncing. Puppeteer would be lip syncing to my voice. So the rules were, gotcha. I was going to do the voices live, but I wouldn't always be puppeteering. But he said, okay, but why would you be doing the voices on a TV show when we can put the voices in afterwards? And so I thought, okay, yeah. I said, but I'm a ventriloquist. So the show is a ventriloquist show, but it's a sitcom. Yeah. It's me and the characters, and I'm a ventriloquist. But we don't go, hey, look at me, I'm a ventriloquist. It just happens. Yeah, but why is it happening? Because you could be cheating. In the edit, the voice could go in. And so that kind of was a bit of a head fuck. and maybe think, okay, yeah, why am I doing ventriloquism if we can cheat it? So then we shot the pilot, and there were bits of it that I think looked great. There was Albert was on a stairlift, a proper stairlift in this flat we shot it, and he's animatronic and he looks great, and he's busy trying to come down, and Sam switches it back up. He's taken the whole show to come down, and Sam presses the button, he goes back up again, so he never gets to come down. And there's some really funny bits, but we realized it needs to be done in front of a live audience to make it work, because the what I do is very live and is all audience based, and so we realized that was the element that was missing. If it was shot like a live show, but filmed in front of a live audience, then when Sam does pop up behind the kitchen counter, but I'm not necessarily operating him, but I'm doing his voice, we can then have fun. The audience know that he's being puppeteered, but I am doing the ventriloquism. Then we can start playing around with it and
we have to be watching you suffer, right? We have to be watching it be difficult for you. Otherwise, what's the point? It's just you in a house with some puppets.
Exactly.
Nuts.
So it's, you know, you have to get it. Once you get your head around it, it kind of makes sense. But so that's the show that I'm developing at the moment.
But
it's got to be done in front of an audience, and they've got to be able to see it. You know, almost that thing where when things do go wrong, like Mrs. Brown has those moments where, you know, that they go again. They point out, it's like it's that sort of pantomime thing, you know, pantomime philosophy, where you break the fourth wall and you say, yes, we fucked this up. We're going to do it again, aren't we? Yes. Okay. This time we're going to get it right. You can do that with the puppets. I mean, I do that with the puppets live anyway.
Yes.
When I do fuck up or trip over a word or something, the puppet will point it out, and people love being let in on a secret they love when you fuck it up, don't they? You know, so it shows that people love an outtake, don't they? So, I thought that if I did do a sitcom live for television, it would have to be, you know, recorded in front of an audience, and you'd keep the mistakes in if they were good, funny mistakes. And then with someone puppeteering one of my characters and I'm doing the voice, I'm still doing ventriloquism. You know that I'm doing ventriloquism, but you don't have to have your arm up the puppet all the time, which is why I use animatronics. So in my live show, Albert's on stage telling me who to pick for a card trick. It's the same thing. It's as if someone else is puppeteering him, but you know I'm doing the voice. You know it's me in my crazy sort of world. And I thought it'd be fun if you then had a puppeteer who's got the script, he knows what the lines are. Then if I start ad-libbing and start doing, you know, saying things and going off script, the puppeteer's then got to lip sync, and then we see how good a puppeteer he is. Yeah. So we can point things out like that as well. And it's like taking the piss out of the whole, whole world.
Yeah, it keeps the ball in the air, doesn't it? Because like what we love about seeing, you know, some of the bits where you're doing multiple voices at once, or even just just you talking to Sam, keeping a conversation going, is it's heroic, because it does it sort of shines with that element of this guy is working incredibly hard. Like you could go wrong at any second.
It's like watching and frequently do.
Yeah, well, sure, but it's like watching a juggler, isn't it? It's like you're doing something that we couldn't possibly do. And so when you just make it, when you, like Seinfeld's thing about to understand how jokes work, Seinfeld has this thing he says about how the cliffs need to be, a joke is a leap over between two cliffs. And if the cliffs are too close together, you just step across and there's no laugh. And if they're too far apart, you fall to your death. They have to be exactly far apart enough.
Yeah.
And it's like we have to see you challenged and yet heroically succeed.
Yeah.
I've seen the supercut on YouTube of all of your America's Got Talent appearances. And it's fascinating watching them all in a row, because you get this kind of perspective on the decisions, a perspective which you must have, or a tiny fraction of it, that you must have on the decisions as to what stuff to use for which bit. Like, do you use your big closer? Do you risk using it too early? Do you, you've got to kind of plan a narrative of like, I've got to surprise them, and then I've got to surprise them again. And how do I get through to the final? Do I use up the thing that gets me to the final? But then when I get to the final, I don't have the thing. And also it was 2015. Was there there sort of is a culture now, a sort of an accepted culture of comedy circuit acts going on to these sorts of shows. You know, when they first started, it was like they felt like they were for kind of random weirdos. And then the format resolved itself into, let's get some really pro people who fancy exposure to a bigger audience and kind of guarantee them through to a certain stage such that they're interested enough in doing it. Do you know what I mean? There's all of those kind of issues. But in 2015, did it feel like a sort of, did it feel like a risk? Did you feel like I might be handing over control of the edit? I might be handing over creative control to someone who could make me look bad if the gig goes badly?
There was always an element of risk, but I think it was very much a calculated risk. From the moment I did my opening, my first spot in front of the judges, walking out of the Dolby Theatre, I was so tired and I was so jet lagged. I'd been there all day.
Yeah,
I'd been waiting hours to go on. I'd been filming lots of B-roll footage for that first spot as well. I felt like they liked me already, even before I did my spot, with all the footage I was doing, all the VT stuff. And then when I walked out, I was so tired. I had a sort of an element of, I don't care about this. I'm so tired.
Was that unusual? Because that really, to me, that's the crux of why that first one was so good, was because your whole attitude, like, God, here we are. Do you know what I mean? Like, presumably that was scripted to an extent.
I wanted to do well. I didn't want to be rubbish on it and get buzzed off or anything. But I was so tired. I just thought, well, look, you've been doing this for a long time. You know what you're doing. You can do this. This is fine. But I was like, oh, fuck it. And I took my girlfriend with me. So I was called for 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and I was told I'd be on at some point in the afternoon. Then I was there. I think we were filming two shows a day, and then they put me back to the second show, and then they put me back to the second half of the second show, and so I'm like, you're ready, and then you're on, and then after a while you just they wear you down, and so you are drained, sort of, you know, emotionally and physically. You're just knackered, so you have to somehow get through that and kind of find an inner something just to get you through and keep smiling. And I thought, okay, just go for it. Just do what you do. And thank God they loved what I did. And that kind of made me go, oh, they like this. Oh, that's good. Oh, all right. This is going well. And then I thought, oh, okay. This might be quite a fun experience then. And they were very helpful, very supportive. I had a producer allocated to look after me and a couple of the other acts. And she said, if you got to the finals, what would you do? What would you do for your second spot? What would you do for your third spot? So I mapped it out.
Okay.
Basically, because I've been touring, working for a long time, I've had lots of different endings to the show over the years. So I could do, I'll finish on that there, but that still saves something else to go to on the next spot. And so you're still building, but each spot has a good ending, but you know you can top it in the next spot if you're lucky enough to get to the next spot. Yeah. So it wasn't like I'd worked out, oh, yes, that's it, that's a breeze, I know how to win this show. Well, not at all. It was, they said, if you got to the finals, what would be your route? What would you do? And so I mapped it out, and they said, yeah, great. Oh, actually, why don't you swap those two for, you know, do that one first and do that one. I went, okay, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. And they were right, absolutely right.
Okay.
But
what was the swap? Why were they right?
The swap was the puppet coming alive versus the human dummy, which I did with Howie Mandel.
Yes.
I can't remember which way round it was.
I think you finished on Howie Mandel, didn't you? I can't remember now. I wish I knew for sure. Yeah.
I can't remember. It's such a long time ago. I can't remember. But it was, whatever it was, that seemed to work. So I was grateful for my producer saying, well, I think that would be better. But most of the time, they kind of trusted me, really. And they just said, what do you want to do? Especially when we were going out filming the VT stuff. And they said, like, you know, when we were doing the live shows, Radio City, and I'd get through to from the quarterfinals to the semifinals to the finals. We were filming lots of VT stuff, and they'd say to me, what do you want to do? And I went, great, let's do some street vent. Let's go and wind up some people.
Right.
Let's hide the camera, and let's throw my voice and see what the reactions are.
Yes, yes.
And then the next week it was, what do you want to do? Let's take the puppets for lunch and have a food fight and do a sitcom scenario. So I basically was planting the seed that I can do a street vent show and a sitcom and all these things, and I've got loads to my repertoire. For a television future. That was my plan.
Yes, gotcha. I was going to ask you whether Howie Mandel was rehearsed into the piece, or if he had any idea.
No, he had no idea.
He had no idea, but was kind of like...
Howie had no idea.
That is great, because his reactions were very genuine. And he was brilliant. He
did
look annoyed, but just to the exact right amount.
But he knows how to play it. And he's, you know, I'd watched other episodes where magicians got him out all the time.
Yeah, right.
And... He was really, you know, giving, very generous. Whereas if you were to get, say, Simon out, on the British show or the American show, it could go either way, you know.
Yeah.
He's the boss, so you can't take the piss out of him.
Yeah, right.
You know? So yeah. Why would you take the piss out of him? Why would you try and make the boss look stupid?
Yeah.
So you've got to be those, you know, when you're, I've watched other people get, you know, different judges out, and you have to be sensitive. That these people have a fucking massive buzzer in front of them.
Yeah.
And it's their show. Why would you want to go on there and insult them? You know, you can insult them, like, if it's with a puppet, I guess it's different. So the baby could say, you know, Howie, he looks like my daddy, you know,
sure.
Like it's a mirror or whatever it was I said. But why would you want to take the piss out of the boss? Because they can literally end your television moment there and then.
Yeah.
So, but someone like Howie was very generous and very, just very giving. And I'd watched him. I was originally going to do it with Mel and Howie, both of them, but we didn't have enough time for both. So we just thought I'd go with Howie. And he was fantastic. And it couldn't have been better. And also, I love the fact that I could go and sit behind the judges.
Yes, I mean, that was great.
No one had done that before.
And
the producers loved the idea of that. So
that was a real kind of gold star sort of a moment. I would imagine, like The Comedy Store, as you said earlier on, and it's sort of known on the circuit, I guess, that it's incredibly difficult to become a regular at The Comedy Store. This is the London one, obviously. But once you're in, it's an easy gig because they've got very high expectations. They're all into it. The setup of the room's brilliant. The sound's brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's an easy gig, but it, you know, there's compared to the fear of being an open micer there backstage going, this is terrifying. And then once you get in the rhythm of it, you're like, oh no, this is why everyone wants to come here, because it's brilliant. I would have assumed that Vegas audiences were something similar. Like, you spend your whole life trying to get to Vegas, and then when you're there, hey baby, it's Vegas and all the shows are sort of in the palm of your hand. So that perspective on actually the fact that, yeah, gamblers, you know, comped rich guys who don't have any investment in the show, people who've lost their life savings, all of that. I wouldn't have expected any of that. Was there a particular, was there like the first day or a particular show that you remember where you went, you kind of splat into something that you had anticipated being much better than it was?
I think at the opening night.
Oh, man.
They brought forward the opening night, and I was doing a spring tour here, in the UK, and so I was literally backwards and forwards, and we were emigrating, so we were moving house, trying to find a house whilst touring here, and I was doing casinos and big theatres and places in Canada, and around America, and then going in rehearsing the show, then flying off again, then coming back, and they brought forward the opening date. So my mind was, it was a crazy time. It was an amazing time, but it was a crazy time, and it was very stressful. And the opening night, and they had a full crew in to film bits of the show which they could use for promotion. And you can see when you look at the footage, I am sweating my tits off, and the audience reaction is half of what it normally is. And so I really, really had to work hard. And there's, you know, there's celebrities in the audience as well. So it was a nerve-wracking experience.
Jeez.
I knew that it was no picnic. I was doing nearly an hour and a half. It's quite a long time on your own.
Yeah.
That was, I didn't expect it to be that hard. And I think you can see, the only other time where I've looked as nervous, I think, was on a Raw Variety show. It was on my second Raw Variety show from the Hippodrome, Birmingham. Brian Connolly was the host, and I did my baby routine, which I'd already done on Bradley Walsh's big stage earlier that year on Channel 5. And Nigel Lithgow produced it, said, I want you to do the same spot you did with the baby. And I went, oh yeah, it's great, I want to do that. And you can see this look of absolute fear in my eyes. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm getting half the reaction I got on the TV show that I did earlier that year. But it's because the set of it is the Royal Variety Show. These people have paid a fortune for these tickets, which go to charity for this show. And there's Ken Dodd, there's Barry Manilow, all these people on the show, and there's me with this bloody baby, and you can just see, I can see myself thinking, oh my God, I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm gonna get a round of applause for that. That's just getting a titter. What's going on? Keep smiling, everything's all right. That's my inner monologue. They'll laugh, it's okay. They can boost the laughs in the edit, it'll be fine. Keep smiling and look at it. It's all marvelous. And I got through it, but I look back and go, oh blimey, you can see that I'm shitting myself.
God. Is there, are there any kind of mountains left to climb in terms of, obviously there's the sitcom and the kind of ambition and your drive towards making stuff on TV, like making your own show, your own sitcom kind of show. But are there any other, you've done Vegas, you've been flown to, I'm sure, to the Cayman Islands to perform for billionaires. You know, you've done all that, you've done the cruises. Are there any other places that you'd like to play that you haven't yet played?
I would like to play some bigger venues around the world. I'd like to do like a world tour. That's what I'd like to do, a proper world tour. And, you know, put on the kind of Vegas show that I did, but tour it.
Yeah.
And you know, to big rooms, which I've been fortunate enough to do some really big rooms in like Canada and America, but I haven't done that. I've done theatres, I've done clubs around the world, but not big rooms. I'd like to do some big rooms, and I'd like to go back and revisit Vegas and do it the way I want to do it rather than the way they wanted me to do it.
Okay. I'm quite charmed by how kind of simple your drive is. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's uncomplicated. Big shows, bigger shows. Make more stuff.
Yeah.
Invent more things. Yeah. Use all the skills you've got. More. I suppose you seem untroubled by the kind of, again, I talked about that, you know, the kind of hobo stand-up comedian idea of the sort of a shambolic person kind of working out their inner demons or what have you. Is there a part of that for you? Is part of your creativity and your performance on stage, is part of it cathartic? Is it sort of an expression of something deeper than simply enjoying, and I don't mean simply in a derogatory way, but simply enjoying making people laugh like you're 15 years old and making the grown-ups laugh?
I mean, that's all it is, isn't it? I'm getting on stage, I'm showing you my puppet show, and I'm wanting you to laugh, and I just want to do it and get as big a laughs and people to laugh, you know, laugh as much as possible, really. I when you've had a great gig, you know what it's like. You come off stage and you go, oh, that felt great. And when you've worked in new material and it's up and running and it's working and you're really pleased, and it's quite simple, really. I'd like to, you know, keep moving it forward and doing things with ventriloquism that haven't been done yet. And I just think, just keep playing around with it, and you never know what comes out of it. So that's a fun thing. It's not, you know, I don't have any major problems in life. That's why I always thought, I was starting to write a routine about, you know, a stand-up routine about the fact that I never did straightforward stand-up because I never had anything to moan about. I didn't have trouble getting to the gig. my wife is lovely. She's not, you know, my mother-in-law, you know, I've had a really nice time, actually, and I've done what I wanted to do, and I'm still lucky enough to do what I want to do. Hopefully, as long as we're, you know, when things get back to normal. So that's why I never had anything to moan about. So I didn't want to be a straight stand-up. But I love the stand-up elements within my show where I'm still using ventriloquism, but showing how I can have fun throwing the voice. Yeah. But it was never, it's not particularly a cathartic thing for me. It's just something I love doing.
And what is your favourite bit of another variety act and why? Like, which bit do you see and you think, I wish I had that. I wish that was, you know, that I'd come up with that.
Well, that's a really good question. One of my favourite routines David Copperfield is one of my favourites. And even though people's perception of him in the UK for a while was that he was this American over the top, big hair, fan blowing, you know, illusionist, but he's actually really funny. And you see some of his comedy routines, he's brilliant. And he does this routine where he levitates a woman from the audience who has a fantasy of levitation, which means she has a secret desire to date a magician. And he does this whole routine where he levitates her on two step ladders while singing like, and his fantasy is to sing like Frank Sinatra whilst levitating a woman.
Okay.
And he does this great, it's such a perfect routine. It's such a perfect routine and an amazing illusion. That's one of my favorite bits of another act. I just love that. One of my favorite acts is a juggler called Frank Olivier.
Oh yeah. Okay.
And who I saw on the Paul Daniels show when I used to go and sit in the audience, and he did a whole routine with the clubs and the helicopter. Yeah. And I just loved his act. I just thought, what a great, it was the first time I think I'd seen a juggler and thought, oh my God, they can be hilarious. And so Frank Olivier and the pickaxes and You know, go and look them up on YouTube. You know, if you're not familiar with Frank Olivier and David Copperfield, Stepladder Levitation. Those are two of my favourite things. I can watch time and time again. And Ray Allen and Lord Charles doing the mind reading with Lord Charles with the dummy blindfolded.
Yeah. So, if you have one quality which got you where you are, besides your performance ability, what would it be?
If I had one, you mean one I haven't got?
No. I mean one that you do have, like not counting the comedy skill, the writing, the talent, like other non-performative abilities that you have that got you where you were. Like, you know, is it focus? Is it slog? Is it, you know, punctuality? non-performative thing?
I think it's obsession. It's good to be obsessed. I'm obsessed.
Has that cost you anything?
Yeah, a marriage.
Has it?
Yeah, I've been so obsessed. My private life has kind of, you know, suffered as a result, I think, because I've just been so single-minded.
Do you ever regret that?
No, because I think if I hadn't have had that drive, I wouldn't have, you know, got to be where I am now. That sounds ridiculous, but got to do what the things that I have done. So I think it kind of is meant to be. In an awful way.
Like that's really interesting because it is, I feel your story of performance is a sort of uncomplicated story of wanting to do a thing, putting loads and loads of work and effort and getting up early and, you know, working hard and making it all work. And as a result, getting to, you know, an extraordinary level, fame, Vegas, all of those kind of things. But I think that the idea of what it costs people, what the price of obsession, is really fascinating because
carry on.
Well, I sometimes wonder about my own relationship to it. I've been through periods of obsession. I wonder in the last year whether the enforced break due to the pandemic has kind of released me a bit of some of the obsession and maybe like the fact that I've been able that at the moment there's very few gigs in my diary. So I can go out on a Saturday night with some local friends and have a pint. And I'm like, I've never been able to do that in 15 years. Yeah. You know, it's quite attractive. Do you know what I mean?
It's nice, isn't it? But at first, slightly unnerving.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I've thought about a lot over the last year when I haven't been, you know, gigging as much as, you know, we would normally be. And that is, well, what if live entertainment is doomed? You know, you have these dark moments where you think, oh my God, you know, and the hospitality sector, entertainment, live entertainment has really, really, really struggled. I saw an old agent friend of mine a few weeks ago, and he said, show business has been decimated. Those were his exact words. And I thought, you're bloody right. And I just thought, God, what if live entertainment doesn't ever come back? What can I do? I can't do anything else. What am I going to do? That's what I thought. So I've only ever done this, you know, from even when I was at school, I was doing, you know, my talent competition, school talent competition. I levitated my sister at the age of 15. I knew I was going to be doing something stupid and weird and funny and silly. I never, ever wanted ever. There was never any question of having a normal job. And so the last year has definitely made me go, wow, what would I do?
Yeah. Last question. And I only ask this of people who I consider to be very successful. Why aren't you more successful than you are?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. Better management. Need better management.
Are you managed at the moment?
No.
Okay.
I left my management because I wanted better management.
Yeah. That's tricky, isn't it? Finding the person that shares the vision. It's like we're talking about with the pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
That must be very hard.
It's really important. And my first agent, when I was 17, she sadly passed away a few months ago. And my first agent, Jenny, she was there from the beginning. She was like, you know, she would be at the back of the room doing a corporate. Mm-hmm. When I was, you know, just starting out, she was there in the TV studio. She was there at all hours. She'd ring me after the gig, you know, driving back from Skegness at 12 o'clock at night, having a terrible time. How was it? What was wrong? You know, and you had someone that was there with you. Mm-hmm. And that was a real kind of sort of old fashioned manager in a way. And I've been managed by lots of massive companies over the last few years and never really had that personal contact with someone where you just get it and they're there with you all the way. Mm. And it's the same as, you know, having a producer that wants to work with you and believes has got the same vision. It's lucky to find someone like that.
Thanks, Paul.
Absolute pleasure, Stuart.
So that was Paul. Thank you so much to him for coming along. There is more stuff with Paul Zerdin on the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, with all of that extra bobbins from Fern Brady, Alfie Brown, Nish Kumar, James Acaster, and those aren't even mentioning all of the extra episodes. There's extras from Greg Jenner, Catherine Bohart, Jesse Cave, loads of people that we've had recently. And of course, all of the episodes as they go out are totally ad-free. So just one more fantastic reason to lock yourself into the Insiders Club. And thank you to a man called George, who recently joined at a regular monthly donation amount far in advance of anything anyone else has done. That's very kind of you, George, and even more kind when you consider that due to the principles at play in the creation of this podcast and the Insiders Club, which is to say my principles, George receives no more extra stuff than anyone else. So thanks once again, George, and everyone else who's signed up recently. So, a brief postamble coming at you shortly, provided Future Girl has shut her beautiful yap in the background. I think she has. So I will now thank everybody and then postamble at you. Thanks to Nathan Wood, who edited and uploaded and produced the show. Thank you very much to Jake Crossland for the logging. Thanks to Rob Smountain for the music and Peter Dobbing for nothing. Thanks, everybody. Find Paul on tour before very long. Go to paulzerdin.com or follow him on all the socials at Paul Zerdin. No postamble this week. Let's all get on with our lives. Bye for now.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.